This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, we'll have a radical analysis of the importance of the summit meeting between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump from Dr. Tony Monteiro, who says the U.S. can no longer demand obedience to Washington's version of how the world should be run. And rebellion continues to simmer behind the prison walls in South Carolina.
But first, the massive popular rebellion that rocked the streets of most of Haiti's cities has brought down the prime minister and cabinet of the U.S.-backed regime. The disorder was ignited by the government's massive hike in the price of kerosene, gasoline, and diesel fuel, under orders from the International Monetary Fund. In Brooklyn, New York, we spoke with Daoud Andres of the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti. Andre is also host of a popular Haitian radio program. He says the people of Haiti want the country's president to step down as well.
You know what's happening? The prime minister and his government fell. But the people are still in the streets because the demand is for the puppet president, Jovenel Moïse, to go. Jovenel Moïse is a sequel to Michel Martelly, who was installed by the Clintons in Haiti. And as many Haitians had said from the very beginning, this was not a president that was issued from legitimate elections that happened in the country. It was fraudulent elections that were done to continue the pillage and plunder that Martelly started. Now, Jovenel Moïse, he came out of Martelly's pocket as an entrepreneur, as an agribusiness entrepreneur, like he called himself the banana man, as if he's someone who was exporting huge amounts of bananas, exporting them out of the country. And his thing was, he had set up a whole scenario. They spent millions of dollars to set up a complete fabrication, like a movie that's happening. And, you know, in Hollywood, they make a set. So they had set up, you know, stolen land that peasants in the northeast of the country, they were making food for their families. So Martelly, around 2014, he created this thing called AgriTrans, A-G-R-I-T-R-A-N-S, and claims that he was planting acres and acres of bananas and some fictitious contract was shown with some company in Germany that they were exporting bananas to Germany. And supposedly that was going to create jobs and be good for the country. And a complete setup to make it like this is the direction of progress, development, that Haiti is going to export bananas, export food to Venezuela to pay for the oil, the Petro-Caribe money that Haiti owes Haiti. But of course, it was all fiction. And within a month or so after the election, this banana plantation did not exist anymore. And these millions of dollars, people realized it was just wasted. So they continued corruption at a level that was really unbelievable in the country. Martelly boasting about building some $9 million vacation home near the ocean in an area called Maui in Haiti. And the people just couldn't take it anymore. About a week, same week that the rebellion happened last weekend, July 6th and 7th, Jovenel Moïse, this little clown, this little thief, he dares to order the transport department to demolish homes of people that were near his personal residence, talking about he wants a helipad for a helicopter to be able to land near his house and the houses of these people that were there way before he came to live there. They were too close to his house for security. And when in the middle of this Brazil against Belgium soccer game in the World Cup, they announced that they were raising gas prices, kerosene and diesel fuel prices. And the people were like, you know, to hell with you, you know. And it was just a massive rebellion. There are no organizations that can claim the leadership of this, and spontaneous throughout the country. And of course, within a couple of hours on Saturday, after their communication minister had come and said that nobody is going to resign, no prices are going to be scaled back, They were forced to roll back this garbage that they had set up. And we are still in the middle of it. This is what's important to understand. Their puppet masters are playing these little games, trying to pacify the population with the resignation of Jacques Lafontaine, the prime minister. But the people are going all the way. We believe that very soon Jovenel Moïse will have to leave, probably absolutely leave the country, as so many others have done before him. People who, thieves, who believe that they could tame, they could, what do you do to rein in the children of the Saline? So on the radio program last week, somebody had called and they were saying, you know, they don't know where this thing came from. And I was like, well, do you know who Jean-Jacques Dessalines is? Do you know how this country became independent? The spirit of Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the spirit of the Haitian people, that when the people rise up, nothing can stop them. And I don't know if your listeners saw some of the footage, people just burning down everything in their path, invading these supermarkets for the bourgeoisie, and just taking everything, going into this hotel, supposedly built with earthquake relief money, $500 a night, that the people of Haiti will never enjoy the benefits of this, will never see this money that the Clintons used to buy the bourgeoisie. And the people just put everything on fire, you know, and they had no choice. They had to back up. And right now, resignation of the prime minister, which he went into this meeting with their puppet parliament, who's in league with them, the people know that, very arrogant, saying that he's going to war, he's going to battle, he's ready for battle. And then he realized that there was nothing to do. And in the middle of this thing, he realized that he was let go because they're trying to preserve Jovenel Moïse. But I don't believe it will work. I believe that the people will continue their uprising, and very soon we will hear that Jovenel Moïse as well has left the country. Because I have to tell you that in Koboko now, the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti, for 3 months now, we've been protesting every week in front of the Haitian consulate in New York with the same message, saying that Jovenel must go. Like, these people, they are not representative of the Haitian people. They are puppets of the enemies of the people. And your folks should know that it's since February that the IMF had basically ordered them to raise the price of fuel, because to make up funds that they're saying are being wasted. But these funds that in the current budget that they are using, the parliament gets something like a 200% raise. The president, you know, massive amounts of money. that the people are just looking at this while the poverty is just unbelievable, unbearable, and they're doing this in face of the people. So this is what had to happen, and it's not the end of it yet, Glenn.
Yes, many Americans don't understand parliamentary systems, and they saw the headline that said the Haitian government is about to fall, and they assumed that the whole structure was falling. But Jovenel Moïse, the president, appoints the prime minister and the cabinet, and those are the elements of his government that have fallen. But Moïse remains.
Moïse is today, as of today, we don't know later this afternoon or tomorrow. He's still president and now supposedly in consultation with the head of the lower house and the Senate. He will propose a new prime minister who supposedly will bring his program of governance and his proposed ministers to the parliament, and then supposedly, if they agree with it, they will approve it. But the parliament is going to fall as well, Glenn, because as I'm telling you, Jovenel Moïse, the United States, like they have this parliament. It's a corrupt parliament. It's a band of criminals, drug dealers as well. And a lot of them, I have to tell you, they took a lot of money, millions of dollars from the prime minister. So they would not have voted to depose him yesterday. But it couldn't work because right now they're trying to save what they can. You see, and this is what we're in the middle of. So whatever deal they make, everybody understands right now that the people, the masses, the children of Dessalines are masters of the streets of Haiti.
But what are the popular organizations that the masses are organized under?
Well, that's the problem, Glenn, is that you don't have a lot of credible organizations underground. There's no organization that can, with any semblance of credibility, say that they were responsible for what happened on Friday and Saturday. This was just spontaneous uprising of the people. You've had different organizations saying different things, but no one was in charge of what happened. This was just the masses in the streets. And I think also it shows the weakness of these organizations, these political parties, that even when they did not organize this movement, they were not in a position to take advantage of it and to bring it somewhere else. So right now, on Sunday, after everything, stuff was still burning. You had political parties coming together, some calling for a general strike for Monday and Tuesday, which we kind of laughed at that. Because if you have rioting in the streets, you have the people running the show, you understand? And no cars could get from one point of the city to the other point. And in the countryside, no movement as well. And the people are just looting everywhere. And you say, you call for an end to the violence. You call for a general strike. Well, inside of this rebellion, there was already a general strike since no one could get anywhere. Anyway, so I think that the people do not trust the politicians. They understand that some of them are trying to be president. They want to be, I'm sorry for using this language, but the head nigger in charge for the white man. It's like a battle, like everybody's denouncing violence. While, of course, everybody sees that this is the only language that empire and its stooges understand. It's the only language that they understand in Haiti as well as over here. There is a mother of one of these children who was killed by the police over here, Margarita Rosario. Beginning of July was her son's birthday, Anthony Rosario, who was killed by the police in 1995. And she was always saying that these cops, they will not stop this until there's a massive rebellion and stuff gets burned down in this country. And I promise you, if that did happen, like what happened in Ferguson, it was generalized throughout the cities of the United States, you would see a completely different attitude by the police. You wouldn't need any sensitivity training for the racist cops. They would get the message. And it's the same thing in Haiti. You see, the government, the IMF, which is owned by the Americans and the other Western powers, they ordered their puppet government to raise the gas prices. You see, and even now they're saying that the mistake that the government did was that the rise was not gradual. The government was doing this, you know, like black cops, you know. Sometimes they are more zealous than the white cops, even in torturing and brutalizing our children. So it's the same thing. It's like they told Moise to do this, and he wanted to please his masters so much that he tried to raise the prices like 51%. Rise in the kerosene. And people are like, what is this? You know, like, are you kidding? Are you serious? But their plan, you know, was that if Brazil won this game last Friday, the people would be celebrating so much that there wouldn't be any serious demonstrations.
Yes, but essentially they seem to have a plan that the people would be drunk behind Brazil's victory.
Absolutely. But we have a Haitian saying that they counted well, but they miscalculated. Bien compté, mais mal calculé. So it's like they had a good plan, you know, because they supposedly distributed $14 million worth of television sets and generators in the countryside, and supposedly, because, you know, they probably stole all of this anyway, but it was all part of the plan to set up the people for the rise of the prices. But, you know, it did not work for them. It did not turn out the way, and this became the catalyst that is bringing their downfall. We don't know what's going to happen right now. Some people are saying, like, who will take power after Jovenel? And it doesn't matter who or what takes power after Jovenel. The progressive organizations, they're very small, lack resources, don't have the organization necessary to take power. So we know that since last week, the United States, you know, has been plotting behind the scenes to see different scenarios that they can deal with to contain this thing. But they don't have control of it right now, is what I can tell you. Everybody understands that the people own the streets.
Do the people feel the power of their ownership of the streets?
They do. And it's not like you can find a spokesperson for the people, because they just act, you know? And I hope that some organizations will use the opportunity to make up for what wasn't done before and try to move it in certain directions. But right now, no one organization can come with any credibility and say that we are the ones. And it seems as if there was no communication between the different cities. Like Godaïve did not speak to Jérémy on the phone to tell Jérémy to start burning down. Cape Haitien did not speak to Okai to tell Okai that we're going to do this. It was just spontaneous. And in the city of Port-au-Prince itself, just like massive destruction that happened.
So the L'Enfantant government is gone, but has the price hike actually been rendered moot?
The same day, since last Saturday, the president, the fake president, we don't call him a real president, the fake president himself, he came out within hours, a couple of hours after the communication minister came and said there will be no rollback of the price hike. And Moise himself, when every car in the parking lot of the Royal Oasis, the biggest, you know, hotel in Pétionville was on fire, Jovenel Moïse came and said, the people have spoken, I have heard the people, and the price hike is scaled back to the prices that, you know, was there before. But people were like, to hell with you, little clown, you know? you have to go. You will go. And, you know, in the press over here, they were focusing on the discomfort tourists, missionaries, you know, who have been for years using Haiti as their little playground, you know, NGOs who use Haiti, the poverty of the Haitian people, to make money, as if, you know, they were stranded in Haiti, they were in danger, they were holed in, food was going to run out in a couple of hours. But we're telling them, you know, Haiti is nobody's playground. Our ancestors did not fight and create this land of freedom so that missionaries can come and tell us to trade our land for Bibles. Our ancestors did not fight so that, you know, people can go to vacation in the sun in Haiti. They created this land as a bastion of freedom, freedom for everyone, as an example of freedom for the whole world. So the best advice we can tell them is get the hell out of there right now. You have nothing to bring us. When you look in the street, everybody just had to stay put and just do not interfere with the people doing what they're doing. Because whatever you were, if you tried to stop them, you know, whatever happened to you, it happened. There's another little clown political hack who was supposedly in the protest movement in recent years. He was in his car on Friday with his security guard and his driver, and he got to a roadblock, and he's trying to get through, and the people are like, are you crazy? You know, just roll back, boy. And his security was stupid enough to listen to this clown and go out with a gun and shoot in the air. The people killed him and burned his body. You understand? This is not protest that brought down the government. It was a rebellion. You see, protest is like Komokoda does these silly things in New York. In Washington, we hold placards, you know, saying, you know, Jovenel must go. You know, we're chanting things. You know, this is not what happened in Haiti. And these things, we understand what they are, and we use them when we have to use them for what we have to use them for. But when business has to be taken care of, and you see, like, over here as well, Glenn, how many millions of people, you know, went to the streets to tell George Bush not to invade Iraq, things like this, that they don't agree with this or that policy. They don't care about these things. You know, you can put out as many people as you want. But when you burn down, you know, the Hilton Hotel, you burn down, you know, the Marriott, you burn down this and that, the message gets across very quickly. Very quickly. And you could see in some of the videos, the police just standing there, frozen. They couldn't do anything. They could not stop the people.
That was Daoud Andres of the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti.
The summit meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, Finland, occurs at a time of clear decline of the United States, economically and in terms of influence in the world. For 3 years, Russia has militarily prevented Washington and its Islamic jihadist proxies from overthrowing the government in Syria, Russia's longtime ally. And the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, with Russia and China in the lead, is creating an alternative economic and political center on the planet, further diluting the influence of the U.S. and Europe. We spoke with Du Boisian scholar and political analyst Dr. Anthony Monteiro. He says the world is quite different than the picture painted by the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Yes, definitely. Then they recognize, or a reality that they prefer not to acknowledge in its full impact. But, you know, in 1992, there was a book published, written by a man, a political scientist, named Francis Fukuyama, entitled The End of History. This was written in the wake of the end of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Eastern European Socialist Bloc. And he said that history had returned to normality. with the hegemony of the white West. Well, 25 years later, practically, we can say that not only was Fukuyama wrong, but history has gone forward almost with a vengeance against the West. You mentioned the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is now joined by Iran and potentially India, which means increasingly the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will be the center of what Du Bois called the unity of Pan-Asia against the West. And the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a military and economic organization opposing Western attempts at domination of Asia, militarily and economically. But I couldn't agree with you more. Not only have lines been drawn, red lines been drawn, opposing or laying down the points at which Asia will defend itself against the West, but now we see the West being pushed back, and Syria is a great example, and potentially Korea is another example, but this is what we're looking at. This is a new reality. How it will go forward, we're still attempting to understand, but it is definitely a new reality.
And Donald Trump is a new reality as well,
yes.
One whose very presence has been a shock to the system. We see that objectively, and for his reasons of his own, he is in some respects pulling the rug out of the old Euro-American version of how the world is supposed to be run.
Yes, definitely. You know, it is ironic, deeply ironic, and it goes against what we often call common sense, that Donald Trump is a president, his presidency is a presidency of peace, the likes of which we have probably not seen since John F. Kennedy. Now, having said that, I would like to qualify it by saying that no post-World War II presidency has been for peace consistently. So to say Donald Trump is a presidency of peace is not to raise the bar too high. But compared to most of what has come before him, when you think of his defiance of the military objectives and military hegemonic objectives of the United States deep state and military-industrial complex, if we think of that and we put in that context Donald Trump's move towards détente with Russia and his move towards détente with North Korea and his keeping in a pretty consistent sense his opposition to regime change, especially in Syria, and his call for military retreat from the attempt to overthrow the Assad government. And having said that, that does not mean that the U.S. is not pursuing genocidal policies in Yemen. But nonetheless, we see signs that this Trump presidency, with all of its contradictions, is pursuing policies against war with Russia, which could easily become nuclear war, and war on the Korean Peninsula, which, again, could easily become nuclear war. So I think these are very important developments in the unfolding logic of 21st century history.
Well, certainly I'm not going to ask you to get into Donald Trump's head, but clearly he is as reactionary in many ways as any president we've ever had, and at least as verbally racist as any
right.
We've had since Woodrow Wilson back in the teens. So clarify further your description of him as a peace president. Just the mere linking of those two words with Trump's name can get some people quite upset.
Yes. And here with Trump, you have to deal with appearance and substance. On the one hand, like you say, he is very disturbing in much of his rhetoric, even his General Assembly speech this past year on Korea, where it sounds like he was preparing to go to nuclear war with North Korea. But then he turns around and has the Singapore summit where he does what no president of the United States had done in over a 60-year history of the Democratic Republic of Korea. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So then with Russia, and this here he has been consistent that he wants, in essence, a detente and peaceful coexistence, and actually the pullback of NATO military forces from the borders of Russia, which are threatening to the government, to the regime of Russia. I mean, this is spectacular. It is, as I have called it before, instances of imperial retreat. What Trump, in essence, is doing, and his actions, I think, as bad as his words can be, his actions speak louder in an opposite direction. What his actions are saying is that to, quote, make America great again, end quote, to invest $1 trillion in infrastructure development, to create an economy that produces, quote, good jobs for the American working class. There have to be several things that happen, including an end to this permanent warfare state. I think there's something that has to be understood here in ways that we will never understand if we remain prisoners of the mainstream media and its ideological predispositions.
Well, certainly the objective reality in the world is that U.S. power is in retreat, objectively. Mm-hmm. But the Trump that you describe is full of contradictions.
Absolutely.
Certainly, and we can see by his legislative agenda, is absolutely incapable of any kind of industrial rejuvenation in the country. His military budget is the biggest ever, bigger by far than the Pentagon even asked for. There is nothing legislatively. There are no proposals that he's made that any of us could do anything but oppose.
Yeah, but then there's something we can support. And this is where he becomes the bête noire, the dark force for the deep state and the military. When he defies them and meets in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin, who they are saying is the quintessential evil, the great threat to the United States, a threat that is on par with ISIS and Al-Qaeda and so-called international terrorism. And now Trump is that. And for Donald Trump to defy the entire state, the entire military-industrial complex, the entire corporate media, most of his own party, certainly all of the Democrats for the most part, and meet with Putin, or for that matter, to meet with Kim Il-sung. This is unbelievable and spectacular. In spite of the large military budget, it's like, you know, he sends up this military budget to make America strong again, quote unquote, but at the same time pursues peace in strategic areas of the world, going against the objectives of the warfare state, of the permanent military industrial state. Yes, it is contradictory, but how could it be otherwise in a regime that is now looking at its own decline and inevitable retreat in the face of a growing unity of nations throughout the world? You know, I have often used W.E.B. Du Bois's language to talk about the geography of the anti-imperialist, pro-humanity united front that we're looking at. He, in the middle of the 20th century, referred to this as the unity of Pan-Africa and Pan-Asia, the unity of what some later on would call the Third World, or the majority of humanity. This unity, which is growing exponentially, and it's not just China, but China is a strategic part of it. It is Africa. It is the growing, you know, this move beyond ethnic and disunifying warfare on the African continent. Ethiopia and Eritrea coming together, and the leaders saying, we are one people, have always been one people. The moves towards unity of the forces of Southern Sudan, and I would suspect a move towards a unity between the Sudan and South Sudan, and a regroupment, as they would have it. But these are important developments as Europe and the Euro-American world faces its own dismemberment, its own disunity, its own internal contradictions and unraveling, as it were, be it in Italy, be it in England, be it in the United States, be it in Germany, be it in Greece, wherever you go in Europe. And then you take the larger picture, the disintegration of the so-called G7 and of NATO itself, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the contradictions and maybe even disintegration of the European Union, this huge economic zone. These are critical and important developments. You know, and frankly, I give Trump more credit than most people do. I don't see him as just a buffoon, although he can be clownish and buffoonish. I think he understands something that many others in the ruling class and in the political class don't want to see. In other words, to save the West has to retreat from its commitment to the single hegemon of the world. And certainly the United States can no longer afford that positioning of itself. So that's the way I look at it. In other words, to put it another way, and I think you know this about me, I see this as a very contradictory moment, but I look at it from a global standpoint as a positive moment of imperialist unraveling and retreat and the ascendancy of the forces of Asia and Africa, that is, the forces of humanity's majority.
Yes, well, certainly all progressives should applaud all moves towards peace.
Absolutely.
Including the very basic type of move, such as meeting with the other nuclear superpower.
Absolutely.
And many of us take great satisfaction in looking at, observing the disarray in the ruling class at Trump's actions, which upset so many previous versions of what the world is supposed to look like. But at the same time, some folks are very upset to see the extent to the right that the Democrats seem willing to go in their opposition to anything that Trump does.
Yes, clearly. But wasn't that already present in the 2016 election? Wasn't it clear that Hillary Clinton and the Democrats were the party of war, not only with Putin and Russia, but also with Syria? Was it not already present that Clinton would continue the war logic of the Obama administration? It was already there. But, you know, because so much of what we call progressives are bound by this lesser of two evils, and they assume that always the lesser evil are the Democrats, they did not understand or did not want to hear what Trump was saying. He made it clear in his election campaign, and we all knew, if we listened, that his policies were less militaristic, less war-oriented than those of Clinton. And that is why the so-called anti-Trump movement has always been a fake or faux movement. It is a movement from above. It is a movement of the corporate Democrats, of the deep state, and the so-called left, and I put quotes, and the so-called progressives signed on and literally made a deal with the devil, a Lucifer pact, and now will have to suffer its consequences, because what they did was go with appearances and old logics and representational and identity politics rather than substance and class politics. And hence, history has moved beyond them. I think, contrary to what is popular opinion, Trump at this point represents a factor, not the only factor, but a factor for peace in the sense that he recognizes, and this is hard for people to understand since he is portrayed as a buffoon and an idiot, he represents an awareness by at least a part of the ruling class, a minor part, albeit, and certainly by a larger part of the working people of this country, of all races, that there has to be a retreat from war. But more than that, a retreat from the neoliberal world order. When he calls for a renegotiation of NAFTA, well, it was the trade union movement back in the mid-1990s who rejected and opposed NAFTA and said it would bring exactly what it has brought, deindustrialization, the movement of capital and industry out of the country, the decline of wages, not just flattening of wages, but the decline of wages, the decimation of the industrial working class. And so we go to Cleveland, we go to other parts, former industrial parts of Ohio, Indiana, we go to West Virginia, we go to Illinois, we go to parts of Pennsylvania, and these former industrial towns are now ghost towns. You know what I'm saying? So when Trump said, we will retreat, we will renegotiate NAFTA, we will reject the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and literally saying that we will withdraw from the World Trade Organization paradigm, the neoliberal global paradigm, this is huge. And that does not mean that all of this does not occur within the framework of every type of political and other contradiction. But I still say it is a turning point. I think it is a breaking of the ruling class. I think it indicates an antagonistic set of contradictions within the ruling elite itself. And I don't think they will ever be able to recover from this. And hence, it provides this moment, provides an opportunity, if we would but seize it, if we would but understand it, if the forces of ideological clarity, of working class and people's politics could rise to the moment, this could be huge for the future of our country and the world.
That was Dr. Anthony Montero speaking from Philadelphia.
South Carolina experienced the worst prison violence in many years back in April. There's very little news from the corporate media on current conditions behind the bars, but activists say the rebellion is still simmering. Ithiel Wangaza is a veteran of the struggle against the criminal injustice system. Wangaza is director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination and also directs WMXP Radio in Greenville, South Carolina. She says the revolt against oppression in the state's prison has not been quelled.
It has not. In fact, the brothers at one of the prisons have recently sent out smoke signals to protest the near year-long lockdown that the prisons across the state are being held in, and also to protest the food, the lack of nutritional food that they are provided. And on weekends, they get these lunch boxes with, you know, a piece of bologna on white bread and maybe something, a chip or something, to go along with it. And that's supposed to keep them for be dinner. And so the brothers had the prison threw them out into the day room and set them on fire as a way of protesting the lockdown and the poor food that they are forced to subsist on. And actually that forces them into the canteen for those of them who have the resources to be able to go in and to buy overpriced, non-nutritional foods from vending machines.
Lockdown for more than a year. That sounds like cruel and unusual punishment on a mass scale.
Totally. And in addition to that, they are going throughout the system, putting metal plates over the windows, purportedly for security and to disrupt cell phone access, which amounts to solitary confinement because they can't tell whether it's day or night. They can't tell whether it's raining or the sun is shining. And they have to be under the glare of artificial light at all times or no light at all. So we know that under international law, more than 15 days solitary confinement is recognized as torture. So to be on lockdown, to be held in cells where the sunshine has been blocked out, there's no natural lighting, and to be subject to unhealthy diets is clearly a violation of human rights and indeed of the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Have any reforms at all come out of the violence or just more repression?
There have been no reforms that have come. It's a gubernatorial race that's going on at this point in time. So the tough on crime mantra is ringing loud and all kinds of punitive measures continue to escalate. From putting nets around the prison yards that are supposed to keep people from throwing cell phones over the wall, to drones, the department buying drones to be able to do surveillance, to putting these steel plates over all the windows, and where they've not been able to put the steel plates over the windows, they have painted the windows black so that, again, folk cannot see in or out, can't tell the time of day or night or the weather. So complete sensory deprivation is, and the failure, continuing failure of black elected officials continue to remain silent, although they have asked to inspect the prisons. They have not pressed that demand, nor have they filed a significant number of them. Our lawyers, they have not filed an action to require that there be an inspection by the legislature, legislative representatives. Family members are still having difficulty being in touch with their loved ones. although the administration says that folk can go to the so-called kiosk and use the telephone or message. Some of them have begun to make notebooks available for people to communicate. They can't get out of their cell to use those devices, even if they were willing to use them, despite the surveillance to which those mechanisms are subjected.
Under conditions like this, it's difficult to imagine how folks are preparing for coordination from the outside and inside for the upcoming strike set for August 21st, the national prison strike.
Well, that's why the administration wants to collect or disable the cell phones to prevent folk being able to organize, to educate themselves and the public as to the abuses to which they are being subjected. However, with or without the cell phones, folks know when their human rights are being violated, their dignity and worth is being discounted. They know when they are being brutalized. And if we think back to the days of George Jackson, which was way before cell phones, folk were able to communicate, to organize, and to resist. So the human mind and the human spirit, as Huey would say, will always overcome man's technology. While there are certain resources that are otherwise available, the grapevine is ever present.
Well, you're a veteran of Black August, of these national strikes. What do you envision?
Well, I think that for South Carolina, it'll be growth. And as folk become more politically mature, willing to take increasing risk, to be more vocal, to be associated and affiliated with folk on the outside, organizations on the outside, which will provide the necessary support in order for them to sustain an action. As I understand it from the last strike, national strike, there were only about two prisons that participated in it. The involvement, even from those prisons, was not very deep. I think that this time around there will be more prisons involved and that there will be broader participation. There is an effort to make sure that there is a place and a space for everyone, that it's not necessary for folk to, everybody to go to the mat, but there are certain, that there's a range of activities in which people can be involved so that they can participate and that they can experience the affirmation of being a part of a national movement.
Many of us remember when conditions inside the prisons were considered extremely relevant to Black political activity on the outside, but that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
Well, I think that to some degree, that's beginning to change. I view those of us who have continued to work in the prisons over since Attica, which was a national message to crush the prisoners' human rights movement in this country. There's been an ongoing effort to rebuild the sense of consciousness, the sense of entitlement, the sense of the right, human right, to have dignity and worth respected. And I think that that effort is beginning to come to fruition. To be able to talk about having a national strike. You know, there have been strikes in various states that have been enjoyed varying degrees of success. And for Georgia, despite the difficulties and the degree of brutal retaliation following the strike there, folk are not deterred. It's come to the point when we're talking about coming to the point where you're having historic numbers of people committing suicide in prison. And the only real power that the prison system has, or that this system, the global system of white supremacy, has, whether you're inside or out, is fear of death. And once people reach a point where they're no longer afraid to die, then they are in fact free, and they can assert that freedom and that sense of entitlement, that sense of worth and dignity that comes of that freedom that no one can take away from them. I mean, the Palestinian people are the model for that standard. We used to be. And I think to the extent that we no longer allow ourselves to be prison shamed as a result of the drug war, where we're thinking, well, they broke the law, or they sold drugs, or they did drugs, we're beginning to get out of that. We're beginning to say, well, how is it that white folks on opioids are victims, but our people are criminals and thus entitled to be locked up for the rest of their lives? How is it that white folks in the Midwest and on the West Coast can be making gazillions of dollars selling reefer when our youth are blemished and crippled for life, held in cages for life, separated from their families, their children, their parents, their relatives for life for doing the very same thing, where doctors can become multi-millionaires, billionaires, the Purdue family, the Purdue company, that they can have their name slapped across museums and research centers, and they've got the whole country in the throes, the death throes of opioids. I think that we're beginning to recover from the disorientation that crack put us under, and to begin to reclaim and reestablish our grounding. And on that basis, to be able to say and to assert the fact that just because it's legal doesn't make it right.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.